Okay. Today I'd like to continue on in talking about textual analysis and finish talking about textual analysis and go on to the next topic, which is speech act theory. So I'm just going to review a little bit about what we talked about last week. Yeah? Last week we talked about how people foreground and background information in their writing by manipulating various ways that they make clause, that is, using various kinds of grammatical tools. And then we also talked a little bit about thematic organization, how people organize the sentences in their writing in order to indicate what information is new information and what information is given information or old information. And so last week we came across two new terms, the term theme and the term ream. And so if I have a sentence, so this is the sample text, yeah? City University of Hong Kong has surged up the rankings of the world's most prestigious educational institutions according to the Times Higher Education Supplement. The university leapt 24 places from 178th last year to 154th this year in the Times Higher Education 2006 World University Rankings released on 5 October 2006. The findings confirm that CityU continues to attract international recognition in both teaching and research. So let's take a look at the first sentence. What is the theme of the sentence? City University, right? City University of Hong Kong, CityU. That's the theme. And the ream is, has surged up the rankings of the world's most prestigious educational institutions according to the Times Higher Educational Supplement. Right? So here we have an adjunct. Right? And the adjunct, of course, is separated by a comma. So what is the subject of the sentence? CityU. And the theme of the sentence? CityU. So is this a marked theme? No, it's not a marked theme, right? It's quite unmarked, unremarkable. Yeah? But you have to ask yourself, well, why did they decide to put this adjunct at the end of the sentence rather than at the beginning of the sentence? Why didn't they write, according to the Times Higher Education Supplement, City University of Hong Kong has surged up the rankings of the world's most prestigious educational institutions? Why didn't they do that? It's not the topic. Well, they don't want it to be the topic, right? So if I made this into the theme, I would make a marked theme, right? So first of all, it would be a marked theme. So if it's a marked theme, I'm going to pay attention to the theme because I think you have some kind of special meaning. Second of all, by making it this theme, right, what you're doing is you're basically making the Times Higher Educational Supplement into the topic of the sentence. Right? But actually, you want CityU to be the topic of the sentence, right? Because this article is not about the Times Higher Educational Supplement. It's about CityU. And so by putting CityU as the topic of the sentence, rather than this adjunct here, right, I'm actually highlighting CityU. You know, I think this idea of highlighting or emphasizing in terms of thematic organization is a little bit confusing because in some ways, you emphasize things by making them the theme, and sometimes you emphasize things by making them the ream. But you're emphasizing them in different ways, right? If you make something the theme, you are emphasizing it as the topic of your sentence. This is what the sentence is about, right? By making something the ream, you're emphasizing it as the new information. This is the new stuff I have to tell you, right? And so CityU is emphasized because it's the topic of the sentence, and they want to emphasize it because it's the topic of the whole article. So it makes sense that they would make it the theme. But the fact that it has surged up the rankings of the world's most prestigious university, that's the new information, isn't it? You already know CityU. You know what CityU is. There's nothing new there, right? The new information typically is in the ream, right? Near the end of the sentence saying, what happened to CityU? What's the new stuff that I have to tell you? And the new stuff is that CityU has surged. What don't they just say, City University has risen? Risen. Yeah. So the color of the word, you know, last time we were talking about different words have different effects, right? So the color of the word, surge, it seems much more aggressive. It seems much stronger. You know, risen is like surge, like a rocket. Right? And so it makes it seem really great. It makes it seem just so fantastic. It makes it seem like a miracle. Maybe it is a miracle. It makes it seem like a miracle that City U has gone from 178th place. That is, there's only 200 in the list, by the way. Yeah, from 178, which is actually pretty bad. Yeah, right? To 154, which is still pretty bad. Yeah, but it's better than before. Right, but by using this word surge, right, it makes it seem very dynamic, right? In the same way they use the word left, right? People in the communication office at City U, they actually have meetings and they sit around and they talk about what words they're going to use. Like, oh, should we use surge this time? No, we used surge last time. We've got to think of a new word. Okay, leapt. We leapt this time. So it sounds very athletic, doesn't it? You know, so leaping over tall buildings like Superman or something like this, right? And so City University is the theme. Surging is the ream with this, all along with this adjunct that comes at the end. Then we have the university leapt 20 more places from 178th last year to 154th this year in the Times Higher. What is the theme of the sentence? The theme of the sentence. The university. Just the university, right? And then leapt from 24 places to 107, blah, blah, blah. All the rest is the ream of the sentence. Now, what can you tell me about this theme and this theme? What is the connection between this theme and this theme? What is the relationship between this and this? They're the same. Okay? So basically, you're starting the second sentence with the very same theme as you're starting the first sentence with, which is not unusual, yeah? Which is actually very, very common in English writing. And it's a kind of typical way of organizing our paragraph, right? So you have a theme, you have a ream, you have a theme, you have a ream, you have a theme, you have a ream, and in order to organize the paragraph, you make all of these themes the same. It makes it easy to follow. So that passage we read last week about the brain, you know, the brain is this, and the brain is that, and it is this, and the brain is this, and just keeping repeating the same theme over and over again. Of course, you don't always want to use exactly the same words in the theme, do you? You don't want to say City University of Hong Kong, City U, every single time you start a sentence. It becomes very boring. And so rather than saying City University of Hong Kong, you simply say the university, right? And then you have the next sentence, the findings confirm that City U continues to attract international recognition in both teaching and research. What's the theme? The findings. Where does this theme come from? Is it the same as the theme of this? No. It's the same as the ream of this. Exactly. Because the findings, what are the findings? The findings are that university leapt 24 places from 178th to 154th. That's the findings, right? And so this is a second typical form of organization in a text where you have the theme, the ream, the theme, the ream, the theme, the ream, but you organize it not by repeating the theme, but by making the ream of the previous sentence into the theme of the next sentence, right? So most passages are organized like this, right? Are there any marked themes in this passage? City University of Hong Kong, is it the subject of the sentence? Subject? Hi. Subject? I'm up. Is it? Hi. Hi. Okay.
The university, is it the subject?
Hi.
Okay. The findings, is it the subject?
Hi.
So, actually no Marx themes at all, right? Which should tell you something, right? It should tell you that, yeah, even though when we hear Marx themes, we don't think they're very strange or very weird, we're not shocked by them in any way. But we can see in the beginning of this whole article here, there are actually no Marx themes. And in the whole article as well, I think there are very, very few Marx themes. Right? And so that kind of emphasizes to you actually how marked these themes are. And so two areas that you need to consider. First, you need to consider this in your own writing. Right? You need to look at your thematic organization in your own writing. And when you do use marked themes, I don't want to discourage you from using marked themes because they're very communicative, right? They have a kind of communicative function. But you only want to use them when you want to reach that communicative function. You don't want to use them when you don't want to reach that communicative function. So when you use a marked theme, like an absolute theme, ask yourself, well, why did I do that? Why did I say, you know, as for the university? Right? What was the purpose of that? Right? And if you can't think of any purpose for doing that, that you're not trying to make a transition or emphasize something or contrast something, then don't use that kind of theme. First thing. Second thing is, when you analyze a text, look out for the marked themes. And ask yourself, okay, why did the people decide to use this marked theme? Right? What kind of effect were they trying to have when they used this marked theme? Or you can even ask yourself, well, here they could have used a marked theme. Why didn't they? Right? And obviously, as we discussed, the reason they didn't is because they wanted to topicalize City University. They didn't want to topicalize Times higher education supplement.
Good.
So the next topic in textual analysis is cohesion, and I'm not going to be talking about cohesion in this class because I talked about cohesion with you last year, and the link is here for the reading from last year where you can go to have a look at cohesion. Does anyone remember what cohesion is? Anyone remember what cohesion is? Alan, you remember? Something about the textual organization, something about the language throughout the whole text. Okay? We actually have two terms, yeah? One is cohesion and one is coherence. Yeah? Cohesion has to do with how the different pieces of text are stuck together. Yeah? So how your clauses and your sentences are stuck together in the text. How I know that this sentence actually belongs with the other sentences, right? Coherence is the overall framework of the text. So, like the overall outline of the text. So, for example, when you read an academic article, it's coherent if it follows a kind of basic generic structure. So, coherence is really very, very close to genre analysis, right? To the kinds of conventionalized moves in genre analysis, right? So the text is held together by your expectations about what's going to happen in the text, right? You can understand the love story that you go to at the cinema because it follows the kind of basic pattern that love stories always follow. And so you're not too confused by it. It's easy for you to understand. That's coherence. Cohesion is a bit more delicate, a bit more exact. It's about the kinds of techniques we use in the text itself to stick the sentences together or stick the clauses together. So cohesive devices are kind of like glue. And so if I have this sentence, I ate my dog, and I follow it with the sentence, it was delicious. What is it that connects this sentence to this sentence? I ate my dog, it was delicious. Let's say she was delicious, because I love my dog, and you know, I regard her as a person, yes, even though I ate her, right? So, what is it that holds these two sentences together? is it? It is a causal relationship, right? That is, the deliciousness of the dog was something. I don't know if the deliciousness of the dog was caused by me eating the dog, but it was something that I experienced because I ate the dog. But grammatically, not logically, not semantically, but grammatically, what is it that holds these two sentences together? What is the word that holds these two sentences together? She or it. She. Right? So she is a pronoun. Right? So one of the chief ways, one of the most common ways that we hold our sentences together so that they logically cohere with each other, right, is by using what's called reference. Yeah? So we use a word in one sentence that refers to a word in another sentence. And since this word is referred to in two sentences, then it makes these sentences connect together, go together in some way. And so there are a number of different kinds of references, right? So, for example, this reference points to something before it. Sorry, not I, to my dog, right? So it points backwards, right? Does anyone remember what this kind of reference is called? Very good. Anaphoric reference. Another kind of reference is what we call cataphoric reference. And that's where the referring word refers to something that comes after it. Can anyone give me an example of that? It's not... I saw her today. Yo-Yo looks wonderful. Okay? I saw her today. Yo-Yo looks great. Okay? So, her refers to Yo-Yo, but Yo-Yo actually comes in the next sentence. Right? This is not so common. The anaphoric one is really, really common. Cataphoric one is not so common. And the cataphoric one has this kind of effect of creating suspense. And so, very often you see it in fiction and stuff like that. Right? So, if I say, I saw her today, Yo-Yo looks great. Right? As soon as I say it, you say, oh, who is she? Who are you talking about? Right? And so it creates this kind of suspense. And, I mean, for fiction, it's great because it kind of drives you into the next sentence. It makes you want to find out the answer in the next sentence. So it pushes you forward in the narrative. And then we have another kind of reference called exaphoric reference. Does anyone remember what that is? That's right. So you're referring to something outside the text, right? If you want to meet Fei Wong, you can come to the concert next week, right? So you doesn't refer to Fei Wong, doesn't refer to anything, doesn't refer to the concert, doesn't refer to anything inside the text. It actually refers to the reader of the text. So the text is actually pointing outside of itself in this kind of reference. Substitution is when we substitute one word for another word. So it's really just like reference in a way, because reference is also doing that. It's substituting one word for another word, substituting she for it. But substitution doesn't use pronouns, right? It uses other kinds of words. So if I say she ate, I'm sorry, I'm losing ink in my marker. She ate the black dog. I ate the white one. Okay? So here, what is the word that, I know, it's very difficult to read. She ate the black dog, I ate the white one. What is the word that joins these two sentences together? One. And what is one a substitute for? Dog. So it's just when you substitute one word for another word. The third cohesive device that we talked about last year is ellipsis. And actually, Edward had a very good example of ellipsis. What was your example?
I'm pretty sure I've got more spare time than you.
Okay. I'm pretty sure I've got more spare time than you. So ellipsis means that you join the two sentences together by leaving something out of the other clause, all right? Leaving something out that should be there, all right? So if I say, I've got more spare time than you, what does you mean? What does you stand for? I've got more spare time than you have spare time, right? But I don't have to say than you have spare time, right? I leave it out. Ellipsis is actually a very powerful kind of cohesive device because the absence of it creates, ironically, paradoxically, the absence of saying something makes it somehow stronger in our minds, right? Because we're the ones who thought about it, right? It's not in the text. We're the ones who thought about it. We're the ones who have to supply that information. Then you have got spare time, right? And so by making us provide that information becomes stronger in our mind and it makes it easier to connect it to the other part of the text. Connecting words, again, are simply words like first, second, you know, afterwards, actually, things like that. Very, very kind of standard cohesive devices. Repetition is when we simply repeat the word, right? So one thing that you'll notice in a lot of these articles on the CityU webpage is that they repeat the word CityU a lot, right? If you read the CityU webpage, you're likely to become very sick of CityU because they keep saying CityU, City University, CityU, City University of Hong Kong, CityU, right? And, I mean, it's typical in any kind of promotional or advertising text to do this, right? Because what you actually want to do is you want to emphasize the product. So you'll also see a lot of repetition in advertisements as well, right? Where typically they repeat the name of the product over and over again. Lexical cohesion is when I don't repeat the word, but I use a lot of words that are related to the word or similar to the word in some way. We say that I use words that are in the same semantic field. Yeah, that is, that they all kind of belong to this topic. Right? So I can say, you know, many people like to eat dog meat. They believe that ingesting canine flesh has a good effect on the health. Some people believe that eating these creatures is not very good, but actually these animals are very nutritious, right? And so what is actually holding the text together is not a repetition of words, but a repetition of similar kinds of words. Dog, canine, creatures, animals. Yeah, and eat and ingest as well. And so typically with lexical cohesion, you find what are called lexical chains. So you can go through the text and trace the lexical chains. And very often, the lexical chain, there are several lexical chains. So in the story I just told, there are two. One is a lexical chain about dogs, and the other is a lexical chain about eating. And this is actually very interesting to do, tracing the lexical chains in the text. Because by looking at these lexical chains, you can see something about the kinds of topics that the writers are trying to emphasize in the text. And I think we did a little bit of work along those lines last year. So I want to end talking about textual analysis just by bringing it back into the social world. One of the problems with textual analysis is that sometimes when we start doing textual analysis, we get lost in the text. Right? We start to think of the text as this kind of abstract object for analysis, and we forget that this text is actually something that's being used to take some kind of social action, that the text is actually somehow situated or embedded in the social world of, you know, people acting, people doing things and stuff like that. And so we have to be very, very careful about that because, as we said in the very beginning of our course, discourse analysis is not just about looking at things that are longer than sentences and analyzing them, but it's also analyzing things within the social context. Right? And so when you're doing textual analysis, you always have to think beyond the text and think about, okay, this text was made by a person to deliver somehow to another person for some kind of social purpose. And so understanding what kind of social purpose that is can help us to understand why they made the grammatical choices that they did. Yeah, and understanding the grammatical choices that they made can also help us to understand something about what they're trying to do with the text, right? What kind of social purpose they're trying to read with the text. And so it's important to remember when we think about grammar that grammar is connected to reality. Grammar is reality, basically. The way your mind organizes language, organizes grammar, affects the way you understand reality, affects the way you interpret reality. Your language makes available certain, what James G. says, certain who's doing what's, yeah? Certain participants and certain processes, right, that are made available in your language or made available in your social world, right? And so what people do when they put sentences together is basically they reproduce our kind of agreed on view of reality, right? Our recognized view of reality. Or they may even try to manipulate your view of reality by using certain terms to refer to certain kinds of people, you know, terms like terrorist, okay? So he's a terrorist, right? And as soon as you use that word to label this person, he becomes a kind of recognizable social actor. He's no longer an individual, right? He's suddenly this thing that you have all of these images of and all of these. So, I mean, probably as soon as I say something like, oh, you know, he's a terrorist, you all have a picture in your mind already. You know, you can't help it, right? You have a picture in your mind. Probably you have a picture of a guy wearing a turban, has a beard, something like this. Must have a beard, right? You don't think of, you know, like me. Well, maybe you do. I don't know. Okay, right? But the fact is that you have a picture in your mind, and we all have a very, very similar kind of picture in the mind. So this really goes to show you how powerful language is in constructing our reality. How we represent social actors, how we represent social actions determines how we think about the world and how we see the world. And how we make who we are and what we do recognizable to others, right? Because everyone in our community has the same kinds of expectations about what kinds of words I'm supposed to use, what kinds of things those people are supposed to do, and what kind of interpretation I'm supposed to give those things. Production formats. I put this down, and actually production formats is a kind of a big topic, but I just wanted to introduce it a little bit, to put it in your mind a little bit, something about the way we produce text or the way we produce language that can be quite crucial, I think, when we're actually analyzing texts, right? When we say things or write things, what we say or write is not always our idea, yeah? Sometimes it's somebody else's idea and we're just repeating their idea, right? And sometimes when we say or write something, it is our idea, right? This is something that we thought of, right? And so what we're saying represents also what we're thinking, right? And sometimes when we write or when we speak, we're not only not saying our idea, but we're not even using our own words. We're actually repeating somebody else's words, right? And so there are basically three positions that you can be in relationship to what you write or say. The first position, I think I'm going to use the screen because my marker is dead. So I'm just going to... Where's Microsoft Office? We use Notepad. The three basic positions are what we call principle, and the principle is the person who thought of the idea. Right? The principle is the person whose thoughts are in the words. Right? Then we have a position called the author. The author is a person who writes the words, or says the words, or creates the words. And then we have an animator. Animator. And the animator is the person who says the words, right? Who animates the words, right? And so, for example, you have a situation like President Bush, okay? President Bush gets in front of the country to give a speech. Right? He says, "My fellow Americans, you know, I'm going to do all this stuff," and he gives this speech, right? Is he the author of the speech? No. And nothing against President Bush. No presidents are authors of their speech. Donald Jang is not the author of his speeches, right? These people are very busy, right? I think it's the sign of being successful, right? When you can hire people to do your homework for you, right? To do your assignment for you, right? And that's basically what he does, right? He has a speechwriter who writes a speech for him, right? And so the speechwriter is the author, the president is the animator, right? That is, he animates, he reads the words of the author. Who is the principal? That is, who is the person who thought up the content of the speech? Vice President Cheney, maybe? Yeah, could be, right? Could be his advisors, yeah? Could even be the president. We don't know. It could actually be him. He could say, okay, this is what I want to say in the speech. Tell the speechwriter, this is what I want to say. You write it, and I'll say it. Right? So sometimes it's possible for a single person to be all three of these production formats at once. Right? You can be the principal, the author, and the animator of what you say. And I expect, for example, in your assignment, when you write your assignment, that will be the case. Right? That what you'll be writing down are your own ideas, written in your own words, written by you. Right? That's the ideal situation. But sometimes when you write an assignment, you don't do that. Right? Sometimes when you write an assignment, you want to actually use the ideas of others, don't you? Right? And so you say, James G. discusses the idea of situated identities, and he says, blah, 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 blah. Right? And so in this case, James G. is the principal, right? But you're the author, because you're not using his exact words. Right? You're just telling what his ideas are. In other cases, you might actually want to quote from the reading, right? Use his words. And in this case, James G. is the principal. James G. is the author of those words, and you are the animator of those words. And so the reason I'm bringing this up, and I'm not going to go into it any more than that, I just want to bring this up in order to alert you that when you are analyzing texts, you've got to pay attention to that. You've got to pay attention to where the ideas are originating from, where these views are originating from. Are they actually the views of the author? And if they are the views of the author, are they the words of the author? Or is the author hiring somebody else to write it or using the words of another person? Right? And how do they represent that? Right? How do they represent that these really aren't words? Sometimes, you have to be tricky, sometimes people don't represent it. Right? Sometimes, like the president, you know, he doesn't get up in front of everyone and says, okay, now I'm going to read this speech that my speechwriter wrote for me. So I've only read it once, and so if I, you know, make some mistakes, please forgive me. You know, he's not going to do that. He's going to stand up and say, "My fellow Americans," and he looks you in the eye and says, "Peace, freedom," right? Things like this, right? And most people, when they listen to the president talk, they actually believe that the president is saying, the words are actually coming out of the president's mouth, right? That those are really his words. Most people don't realize that those aren't his words. So you have to be careful about it sometimes, because sometimes people don't represent who the real principal or the real author of the words are. Sometimes they emphasize who the real principal in the words is. For example, if I say, Edward thinks that, discourse and pragmatics is not very useful to make money, but actually I think you can make a lot of money by studying Discourse and Pragmatics. And so by saying Edward thinks and then using Edward's words, I'm emphasizing that this is not my opinion. So I'm distancing myself from these words. Yeah, I'm representing these words as coming from another person. So that's just something to pay a little bit of attention to when you're analyzing a text. So we've had some discussions about this on the discussion board, and this is something we talked about last week. And this is a distinction that I think is very important to make, particularly if we're reading the work of James G., because this is like the main distinction he makes in his studies, the distinction between big D discourse and little d discourse. Yeah. So when you are studying grammar, what are you studying, big D or little d? Little d. Yeah, grammar is the little d. Okay? So the point of textual analysis is not to get stuck in the little d. Okay? Not to get trapped in the little d, but to try to understand what is the relationship between the little d and the big D. Right? How do the grammatical choices that the authors make support the communication or the expression of a certain kind of discourse, big D discourse, which is, when we talk about a big D discourse, we really mean a kind of way of being. We really mean a kind of ideological position, right? We really mean a kind of social identity, right? And so this social identity is expressed not just from the grammar I use. It is expressed from the grammar I use, but not just that. It's also expressed by, you know, things like what I think, what I value, how I act, what I wear, how I interact with others, and this sort of thing, right? And so these discourses are very important, and we recognize these discourses in our lives. Right? It's part of being part of our community of practice. And so when we go to the doctor, when we go to the clinic, right, and, you know, we see a bunch of people there, right? Some people are nurses, some people are doctors, some people are students, and some people are, you know, maybe cleaners, yeah? It is unlikely that we're going to go to the clinic and we're going to go up to the cleaner and say, I have a kind of a sore throat, right? Because we know that the cleaner is not a doctor. How do we know the cleaner is not a doctor? Many ways we know. First of all, by the way she's dressed or he's dressed, right? That the cleaner wears this kind of blue uniform and the doctor wears a kind of white uniform, right? We also know by where they are. Right? They're not in the examining room, they're outside. We know by what they're doing. They're sweeping the floor. Normally doctors don't sweep the floor. We know by the way they talk, right? That the doctors talk in certain kinds of ways and cleaners talk in other kinds of ways. So when we go to the doctor's office, we do this kind of recognition work, right? Where we recognize, we look around, and immediately we know, okay, these are the patients, these are the doctors, these are the nurses, right? These patients are staff members and these patients are students. You know immediately who's a staff member and who's a student, don't you? That's what we mean by recognition work. That you recognize people as certain kinds of types of people, certain kinds of social types based on the discourse, big D discourse, that they're expressing. But when we write texts and when we read texts, one thing that we will notice sometimes is that the texts don't always just contain one discourse, right? That sometimes the text will contain several discourses, right? For example, if you read the CityU website, there are two main discourses that are presented. One discourse is the discourse of education, right? So education is a value. We should learn for learning's sake. Knowledge is a value. These sorts of things. But the other discourse you see on the website is a discourse of commercialism or commodification, we might call it, where CityU is, you know, if you get this degree, you're going to get a good job. All of our graduates get really good jobs. Our graduates make a lot of money. You know, our graduates, we mean business. You know, we surged, and you're going to surge too. All this kind of rhetoric that's like advertising rhetoric, right? That instead of treating education and knowledge as this kind of, you know, good in itself, you know, a value in itself, it actually treats education knowledge as a commodity that you can use in order to buy yourself a good job. Right? So we can say that there are two competing discourses in the City University website. And this is what we call a big C conversation. So a small C conversation is the conversation that we're having with each other. A big C conversation is the conversation between two discourses. Right? That is, for example, the discourse of education and the discourse of commodification. So when you see these kinds of two or three or more different discourses in a text, this is called heteroglossia. Heteroglossia. Hetero means different. Gloss means tongue. Yeah. So heteroglossia basically means there are different voices in the text, right? Different voices that are expressing different discourses or different ideologies. Another way to express this is a word that we learned last year, intertextuality. Okay? Intertextuality. So James G. gives a very good example of a heteroglossic text in his analysis of this label from an aspirin bottle. Right? So this label from the aspirin bottle, it goes like this: warning, children and teenagers should not use this medication for chickenpox or flu symptoms before a doctor is consulted about Ray syndrome, a rare but serious illness reported to be associated with aspirin. Keep this and all other drugs out of reach of children. In case of accidental overdose, seek professional assistance or contact a poison control center immediately. As with any drug, if you are pregnant or nursing a baby, seek the advice of a health professional before using this product. It is especially important not to use aspirin during the last 3 months of pregnancy unless specifically directed to do so by a doctor, because it might cause problems in the unborn child or complications during delivery. See carton for arthritis use, an important notice. And so what G points out about this text, although the text, for most of us when we read it, we don't think there's anything unusual about it, if you really analyze the text, you get the feeling that basically more than one person wrote it, that there are two kinds of views of aspirin that are presented in the text, two different feelings about aspirin that are presented in the text. In some of the sentences, it makes it seem like aspirin is a really dangerous thing, right? That aspirin is something that you really need to be afraid of, right? And these are the sentences that are marked in red here. Children and teenagers should not use this medication for chickenpox or flu symptoms before a doctor is consulted about Ray syndrome, a rare but serious illness reported to be associated with aspirin. It's especially important not to use aspirin during the last 3 months of pregnancy. All of this in capital letters. And so all of this information is basically telling you aspirin can kill you. This product can kill you, or it can kill your baby. If it doesn't kill you, it's going to kill your baby, right? So it's quite strong language. It's quite alarming language. Serious illness, right? Especially important, uppercase letters, this sort of thing, right? And, you know, really the drug company needs to put this on the label, yeah? Because if somebody eats the aspirin and they die, yeah? Or if somebody eats the aspirin and their baby dies, right? Then they can sue the aspirin company. They can say, oh, you didn't tell me, you know, it's going to kill me. You didn't warn me about it. So the aspirin company is legally required, right, to put this on. They put it on in order to reduce their legal liability, right? So nobody can sue them if they die, right? So this you can think of this language as language written by lawyers. Right? This is the lawyer. The lawyer at the aspirin company is writing this text. Right? But if you look at the rest of the sentences, you get a kind of a different idea about aspirin. Keep this and all drugs out of the reach of children. Right? So this and all drugs out of the reach of children. It's like aspirin, yeah, aspirin is just like all drugs. Nothing too scary about aspirin. Nothing special about aspirin. After all, you should keep all drugs out of the reach of children, not just aspirin. So aspirin's okay. You know, it's just, you know, just like any other drug. No problem, right? In case of accidental overdose, seek professional assistance. Right? Seek professional assistance. It's quite different from going to a poison control center, right? Seeking professional assistance sounds very kind of soft, doesn't it? Like, here you are, you've eaten the aspirin, you're dying, you know? I think I'm going to seek professional assistance. You know, you get to the hospital and say, doctor, I'd like to seek your professional assistance on this matter, right? You're dying, my God, right? And so you can see this kind of language kind of softens the whole idea, right? Rather than making the medical emergency seem very urgent, it makes it seem like, you know, an appointment at your hairdresser or something like that, you know? You just seek professional assistance. As with any drug, if you are pregnant or nursing a baby, seek the advice of a health professional. So again, rather than making aspirin seem especially dangerous, it actually says, oh, all other drugs are like this, you know, it's just like any other drug. And again, you know, seek the advice of health professionals. Again, it's a very, very soft kind of thing. It doesn't seem very dangerous. It doesn't seem very urgent. So this was written by the aspirin salespeople. Right? The people who want to sell aspirin, right? They still need to warn you about certain things, but they don't want to alarm you. Right? The others, they actually do want to alarm you. And so you get two different feelings in this text. Right? One feeling is this feeling of alarming you, and the other feeling is this kind of feeling of comforting you. And say, oh, aspirin, it's not so dangerous. It's not something you have to worry about too much. Okay, let's take a break, and we move on to our next topic, speech act analysis. Just to give you another idea about this idea of conversations, this idea of different voices, heteroglossia, mixing discourses in texts, I'm going to go back to a few slides from genre analysis that I didn't cover when we talked about genre analysis, and that is the idea of mixing genres. Right? So mixing genres is basically taking two different kinds of generic conventions and putting them together in the same text. So, for example, it's not a very good picture, not very clear, but this is an advertisement from the MTR for a kind of biscuit, yeah, called Lou Biscuits, yeah? And so we have this advertisement for the biscuit. We have a picture of the package of biscuits. We have the name of the company that made the biscuits. All of these things are things that you would expect to see in an advertisement for biscuits. Yeah? But then there's something else here that's very strange. You get different kinds of views of the biscuit. Right? So you have the front view and the side view over here, and you have this kind of view of the biscuit. And so they give you the biscuit in three views, which is actually a little bit unusual for advertisement about biscuits. What kind of genre would you expect to see this kind of stuff in? Oh, yeah. It's more for like a technical thing, like a computer or some kind of technological gadget or iPod or something like that, or maybe even a piece of furniture or something where the dimensions are quite important. Scientific texts, you would expect to see this kind of thing in, right? Engineering texts or architectural texts, right, where they have to show you things from different perspectives, right? And so this biscuit advertisement mixes the discourse of selling biscuits, the discourse of advertising, with another discourse. The discourse, really, I think the discourse of technical communication or scientific communication. And by doing it, they create a conversation between these two discourses, between the discourse of biscuits, the discourse of advertising, and the discourse of technology, the discourse of scientific writing. And so by mixing these two discourses together, by creating this conversation, they create a certain kind of feeling for these biscuits. They make you feel like there's something about these biscuits that are a little bit high-tech, right? So high-tech biscuits, right? You feel like, wow, this biscuit, it's, you know, really, it must be very special in some way because they're using this kind of scientific generic convention to describe the biscuit. I think I talked about this one last year. Do you remember this one last year? Yeah? So this is another example of mixing genres, right? This is a Benetton advertisement, right? An advertisement for clothing, right? You know, the Benetton advertisements, they're always really strange and really kind of shocking, right? They put lots of people of different races together. Sometimes they put people who have disabilities, you know, in their advertisements. Sometimes they put, you know, people with diseases in their advertisements in order to kind of shock the reader, right? This is an advertisement selling clothes, but I don't think any of the people in this picture are wearing Benetton clothes. They don't actually look particularly fashionable in what they're wearing. Right? This is actually a picture of a man dying of AIDS, and this is his father, and this is his mother, and this is probably his sister, right? Are by his bedside, right? You know, comforting him in some way. But as I told you last year, this picture represents mixing discourses, because on the one hand you have the discourse of clothing advertisement here, but on the other hand, from the composition of this picture, this reminds you of the discourse of Christian art. So last year I told you that this picture has a composition very, very similar to many Renaissance paintings depicting Mary and the other disciples taking Jesus down from the cross. Yeah, so Jesus was crucified on the cross, and they took him down. And usually you have Mary, but Mary is now the father here. You have Mary, right, who's holding him, and then you have Mary Magdalene, usually there somewhere around here, and then, you know, maybe some of the other apostles there like that holding it. So particularly people in Italy, where this advertisement was produced, as soon as they look at this picture, they think of Jesus. Right? They think of Jesus. So it kind of mixes the discourse of religion and the discourse of disease and the discourse of selling clothes all together, right, to create this kind of very strange, very, very shocking effect with this advertisement. And so you can see, especially in advertising texts, heteroglossia, mixing discourses together, is a very, very common kind of technique that you can watch out for in your own textual analysis. Okay. So now we get to talk about speech act theory and pragmatics. And we only have about 40 minutes to talk about speech act theory and pragmatics, so I doubt if I'm going to finish all of it today, but at least we can get a start. It's okay, in the other class I didn't finish either, so everybody is kind of equally behind about half a lecture. Yeah, we actually already talked a little bit about speech acts, and we've talked about the ethnography of speaking. And in the ethnography of speaking, we talked about how Hines divided up speech situations into three parts: a speech situation, a speech event, and a speech act. Which of these things is the ethnography of speaking mostly interested in? Speech event. Right? So what we do with the speaking model is we basically use it to interpret a speech event. Give me an example of a speech event. A baptism. You know, when they bring the baby into the church and they put water on its head? Yeah, baptism. Okay, good idea. Baptism is a speech event, right? So you go to the church, you know, and you sit there, and do they say, okay, we have a new baby to be baptized. They bring it up to the front, they put water on its head, they say prayers and stuff like that, right? And so we can analyze that speech event. That speech event is part of a larger speech situation. What's the larger speech situation? The church service, right? The church service. Right? So sometimes distinguishing between a speech event and a speech situation can be a little bit difficult, right? It can be a little bit ambiguous, right? So, for example, we can say you have a speech situation of your day at City University. Your school day is a speech situation. And maybe your lesson in discourse and pragmatics is a speech event within that speech situation. But the lecture on discourse and pragmatics can also be seen as a speech situation in which there are separate speech events. Right? The lecturing section, the activity section, the question and answer section, these different kinds of sections. So each of these speech events is made up of a speech act. Right? So, for example, if we have the speech situation of a wedding, right? Someone's getting married, they're having a wedding. The wedding can be divided up into different speech events. For example, the wedding ceremony, the wedding party. Yeah? In the wedding ceremony, that can be divided up into different kinds of speech acts. A speech act is when somebody utters something, one utterance, and that utterance has the effect of doing something. Right? So what kinds of utterances, what kinds of sentences, what kinds of speech acts would you expect in a wedding ceremony? What do you have to do in a wedding ceremony? What do you say? You say, "I do." You say, "I do." Right? The speech act of saying "I do." Right? What is the speech? What is the speech act there? When you say "I do," what are you doing? I mean, you say "I do," and then the priest says, "You do what?" Right? That's right. So it is the speech act of promising. Right? So basically by saying "I do," you are making a promise. Right? So that's the speech act. There's another speech act that's very, very important in a wedding ceremony. In fact, you can't even have a wedding ceremony if you don't have this speech act. And that's the speech act that the priest or the clerk of the court or the magistrate or whoever is performing the ceremony, they say this. And if they don't say it, you're not married. What do they say? That's right. I now pronounce you man and wife. So it's a pronouncement, right? It's a pronouncement. This is actually a very, very special kind of speech act called a performative. Performative. Because by doing this speech act, you are performing a kind of action, right? You are changing the situation. So when the clerk or the magistrate says, "I now pronounce you man and wife," you are man and wife, right? You are man and wife. By him saying that, he makes you man and wife, right? So a performative speech act is a very powerful kind of speech act because by uttering it, you make it so. Just by saying it, it becomes true, right? You weren't married, and then I said, "Now you're married," and you are married, right? From that moment, right? So the thing about performatives, they're very special kinds of speech acts because only certain people can utter them, only at certain times in certain places. So there are a lot of conditions that have to be fulfilled in order for the speech act to have the power of a performative, right? And so, for example, if I walk up to Yo-Yo and Alan and I say, "I now pronounce you man and wife," are they married? I said it. Are they married? Is it? Why not? I am not qualified. Right, to utter that speech act. Right? If I utter that speech act, it doesn't matter. It has no force. It has no power at all. Right? So first thing is you have to be the kind of person who can utter it. Right? Second of all, if you're a priest, right, and you walk into the Pacific Coffee and you see a couple sitting there and you say, "I now pronounce you man and wife." Are you married? No, you're not married, because he's not doing it in the right place. Right? He doesn't have the right context. You know, priests can't just, go out in public and willy-nilly make people be married, right? There has to be some kind of conditions, right? It's got to be at a certain time in a certain place. Other examples of these kinds of speech acts are you're under arrest. Yeah? You're under arrest. So a policeman is the person who can utter the speech act, "You're under arrest." And when they say, "You're under arrest," you're under arrest. Right? That changes the situation. Before he said that, you weren't under arrest. And as soon as he said that, now you are under arrest. You are arrested. right? But I can't say that, right? I can't go down to the MTR and say, hey, you, you're under arrest. They're going to say, who are you? I'm a lecturer at City University. Want to see my ID, right? Because, again, I don't have the power. I don't have the power to do that, right? So performatives really depend very, very much on the identity of the people who perform them. So what about, let's just take one of these. What kind of speech acts would you expect at a trial? At a trial. Yeah. At a trial. Well, I mean, the first thing you do at a trial, right, they call the witnesses, right? And the witnesses come up, and in America, they always put a Bible in front of you, right? And you've got to put your left hand on your Bible, and you raise your right hand, right? And you say, I swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. What kind of speech act is that? Swearing, or vowing. It's a kind of vow. Or so. It's very similar to a promise, isn't it, right? And then the witness sits down, and the solicitor, or the barrister, rather, the barrister will come up and start doing something, start performing speech acts. What kind of speech acts does he perform? What does the barrister do? What does he say? Where were you on the night of July 14th, 2005? What were you doing? Did anyone see you there? Right, what time did you leave? Right, what are those speech acts? Questions. Right? So a question is a very, very important kind of speech act in this kind of situation. So you can see that different kinds of situations, different kinds of speech acts are going to be associated with different kinds of situations. And it is the speech act which is kind of like the smallest building block for speech events. Right? And the speech event is the building block for speech situations. Speech act theory was invented by two philosophers, actually. They're not even linguists or discourse analysts. They're philosophers named John Austin and John Searle. And their idea was that if you really want to understand what people mean by what they say, you've got to look beyond the meaning of what they say. That is, you've got to look beyond what they call the propositional content of the sentences they say, right? So, you know, if I say a sentence, do you know what time it is? Right? The propositional content of the sentence, the meaning of the sentence, is that it is an interrogative sentence. That is, it's a question. And it is a question which asks about your ability to tell the time, isn't it? Right? So they said, if you just go by the propositional content, then we couldn't understand each other. Yeah? Because you would have a situation where I would say to somebody, do you know what time it is? And they would look at their watch and they would say, yes, I do. You don't, I do. Right? Because all they're focusing on is the propositional content. Right? And very rarely is the propositional content of our sentence what we actually mean by the sentence. And so Austin and Searle had this idea that we analyze sentences not according to the meaning of the words, but according to what they call force. Yeah? Force means the kind of effect that the sentence has, right? The kind of power that the sentence has. And they divided this idea of force into three kinds of force. First kind of force is called locutionary force. And locutionary force is actually very, very close to propositional content. The locutionary force is simply the meaning of the words. Right? The meanings of the words that I uttered. Do you know what time it is? Okay? A question asking about your knowledge. Yeah? The second kind of force is really the most important kind of force when we talk about speech act analysis, and that's illocutionary force. Illocutionary force is what you are trying to do, right? So when I say, do you know what time it is? What I am trying to do is not determine the state of your knowledge. What I'm trying to do is get you to tell me what time it is, right? So I am using this speech act in order to try to get you to do something, right? That is, tell me what time it is. And the perlocutionary force is the result. The perlocutionary force is whether or not you tell me what time it is. Okay? So, all sentences have locutionary force and illocutionary force, but not all sentences have perlocutionary force. That is, I could ask you, I could say to you, do you know what time it is? And you could say nothing and walk away. Right? And so the force of my sentence has no effect at all. Right? No perlocutionary force, no result. Okay. So locutionary force, the meaning of the words. Illocutionary force, what I'm trying to do with the words. Perlocutionary force, what the result is. Right? What the actual physical result is. The problem is that it's not always so easy to tell from sentences what the illocutionary force is, because very often we make our speech acts in rather indirect ways, in rather tricky ways. So if you have a sentence, we would like to thank customers for not smoking while in this store. Right? And so the locutionary force of this sentence is thanking somebody. Right? But is that really what this sentence is doing? Is this sentence really thanking people? What is it really doing? It's warning people, isn't it? Right? It's a warning. Right? But rather than saying, we warn you not to smoke in this store, they say, we would like to thank you for not smoking in the store. So it's a very, very nice way to do it, a kind of polite way to do it. Right? But the actual locutionary force is not the force of thanking, it's the force of it's the force of warning. So sometimes it's a little bit difficult to actually identify what the illocutionary force is. Sometimes you have to look at the context of the situation to understand what the illocutionary force is, right? So, for example, if I'm on the MTR and I ask the person next to me, do you know what time it is, right? The illocutionary force is a force of a request, right? I am asking you to tell me what time it is, right? But if I'm in a primary school classroom or a kindergarten classroom and, you know, I say, Alan, can you tell me what time it is? And the clock is right there, right? Now, Alan is not going to say, well, the clock is right there, can't you see it? Right? Because the illocutionary force of that statement is basically a test, isn't it? To test to see if you know what time it is. Right? And so the sentence is going to have different illocutionary force in different kinds of contexts. Sometimes speech acts can be spread over several sentences, right? You have to actually look at several sentences to understand, oh, exactly what they're doing with the words. And sometimes you can have more than one illocutionary force in one utterance, and I'll show you an example of that in a second. So Austin and Searle, they divided speech acts into basically five kinds of speech acts, right? One they call a representative, right? And a representative is simply a speech act where you convey some kind of information. You convey something that you believe, right? The sky is blue, right? The sky is blue, right? Is what we call a representative. All you're doing is saying something about what's true, okay, or what you believe to be true. A directive is a kind of speech act where you're trying to get somebody to do something for you, okay? So things like giving somebody an order, or making a request, or making a suggestion, right? These are directives. A commissive is where you are committing yourself to doing something. So I do is a commissive, right? It's a promise. I promise to meet you on Saturday, right? I vow to uphold the Constitution of the United States, okay? These are commissives. A declaration is basically a performative, right? So I now pronounce you man and wife, you're under arrest, things like that. And an expressive is a kind of speech act that expresses your personal feelings, right? Often things like exclamations like ouch and ooh and yuck, right, are examples of what we might call expressives. And so I have a little chart here that gives you some examples of the different kinds of speech acts under each category. So under representatives, to swear, hypothesize, claim, announce, insist, forecast or predict our representative speech act. Under directives, asking, begging, commanding, bidding, ordering, forbidding, recommending, suggesting, inviting, challenging, directing, instructing, and requesting are all directives. That is, they're all speech acts that we use to try to get people to do something. Right? Expressives are when you express your feeling. For example, you can apologize, you can thank, you can deplore, pardon, congratulate, reject, regret rather, or commiserate. And commissives, things like promise, pledge, swear, volunteer, offer, vow, threaten, and finally declarations like wed, baptize, as Alan said before, christen, name, define, call, dub, abbreviate. Right? So if I get a new boat, right, maybe my old boat is getting too old, I need to get a new boat. Right? And so I'm going to call my boat the SS Discourse and Pragmatics. Right? And so I get a bottle of champagne, and I go out to the boat, and I smash the bottle of champagne on the boat and say, I will call my boat Discourse and Pragmatics. Right? By the act of doing that, now that's what my boat is named. Right? So the act of naming, right, is an example of one of those performative speech acts. But some speech acts are not, as I said before, they're not so direct. Right? Some speech acts are very easy to figure out. They're very, very direct. And very often we use the kind of verb for the speech act to signal the speech act. Right? So I promise I will marry you. Right? Is a promise. Right? I swear that I didn't do it. Right? I vow never to do it again. Right? All very, very direct speech acts. Right? But often we don't make our speech acts direct. That is, the locutionary meaning and the illocutionary meaning are different. Right? There's a gap. Right? So, for example, can you come tomorrow? Can you come tomorrow? What kind of speech act is that? Can you come to my house tomorrow? Can you come to my house tomorrow? What am I doing? Invite. Yeah, I'm dating you, right. I'm inviting you, right? So it's a speech act of invitation. But actually the locutionary force of this speech act, can you come tomorrow, is a question about your ability to come, right? So there's a difference, you see? If I say, can you come tomorrow, you understand that I'm inviting you. But if you actually just went according to the meaning of the words, you might say something like, sure, I can come. I have two legs. You know, I'm not, you know, disabled or anything. No problem. I can go anywhere I want. You know, that sort of thing. I didn't know I made you angry. I didn't know I made you angry. So the locutionary force of that is a statement, a representative, right? Talking about, you know, what I know and what I believe, right? But what is the illocutionary force of that speech act? Right, apologize, right? But I'm not using the word apologize. I'm not saying I'm sorry or I apologize or anything like that. I'm saying I didn't know I made you angry. Right? I suggest you get out of my office before I punch you. Yeah? Is that a suggestion? No, it's not a suggestion. What is it? It's an order, okay? And so very often we use other words, right, to kind of mask the speech act that we're actually performing. I have a little task for you here. This is from a telephone answering machine. Yeah, the recording says, this is 94571769. I can't answer the phone right now. Please leave a message after the tone. And then the person who's calling says, it's me again. I'm trying to organize the barbecue for John's birthday on Saturday. Can you give me a call and let me know you'll be coming, right? So one, two, three sentences here, one, two, three sentences here. Analyze these sentences and tell me what is the locutionary force of the sentence and what is the illocutionary force of the sentence. So basically we have three kinds of sentences in English, yeah? We have a declarative sentence,
We have an interrogative sentence, and we have an imperative sentence. What is a declarative sentence? Give me an example of a declarative sentence. Kenji. Okay, that's a declarative sentence, but it doesn't have to be, doesn't necessarily have to be a performative to be a declarative sentence. Because this is not about speech acts. This is just about grammar. Right? So, I ate my dog is a declarative sentence. Right? The class is at 6:30 is a declarative sentence. Right? So, a declarative sentence is a statement. Right? A statement. Interrogative sentence, give me an example of an interrogative sentence. Alan?
Are you here?
Are you here? Who ate my dog? Right? So an interrogative sentence is a question. Right? And then an imperative sentence is shut up, leave me alone, get out of here. Right? It's a directive. It's a command. Okay? The way you can usually tell an imperative sentence is the subject is left out. Right? So shut up, what's the subject of shut up? It's you, but you is gone. Right? So the first sentence here, this is 9, 4, 5, 7, 1, 7, 6, 9. What kind of sentence is this? It's a interrogative sentence? Imperative sentence? Declarative sentence. Very good. It's a declarative sentence. A declarative sentence. And the meaning of it, what is the meaning of it? What is the meaning of it? Okay. Identifying the number that you've just called. Right? They are so you call up, the answering machine answers, and they tell you the number that you have called. Right? So the purpose of it, from the point of view of the locutionary force, is to give information regarding the number that you called. Is that the illocutionary force of the sentence as well? Can we say, for example, that this sentence is a representative? A representative speech act? That is, it's a speech act simply telling a fact. Right? Is that the only purpose of this sentence? Edward?
No.
No?
It's trying to say, this is my number, do you make a wrong call?
Okay. Maybe, but it's not that it's actually accusing. I mean, you're right, it could be kind of accusing somebody of making a wrong call or clarifying.
To inform the other one if you made the right call.
Okay, so one purpose of it is to so you can be sure that you made the right call.
Yeah.
Right? But if I call up Alan, right, and then I hear Alan's voice on the voicemail, right, that says, hi, this is 9457-1769. Right? Do I know that it's 9457-1769? Do I know that? I know that. I know that. I already know that. And in fact, I even know it's Alan, because I recognize his voice. Right? And so, in some ways, this information is really unnecessary. It does help to clarify, so I know that I called the right number, but anyway, I'm the one who dialed the number. I know who I'm calling. It's not really necessary to tell me the number that I just called, isn't it? So it must be performing some other kind of function as well. Anyone have any ideas about what other kind of function it might be performing? Okay, well, we know he's not available to receive the call, but that's the next sentence where he says that. So if identification, it's almost a kind of greeting, isn't it? It's almost a kind of way of saying hello, right? By identifying yourself, right? In fact, sometimes we do say hello by identifying ourselves, right? So, for example, Alan is in the disco, yeah, right? And he sees this cute girl, right? And he walks over to her and he says, I'm Alan, right? Simply by identifying himself, he's greeting her. He's saying hello. We don't even have to say hello. All he has to do is identify himself, right? So it also, along with being a representative, it has the force of a greeting.
So here's an example of an utterance that actually has two illocutionary forces, right? Has a double force, right? It functions as a representative to confirm the information about the number that I called to make sure I haven't called the wrong number, and it also functions as a greeting because it's the first thing the person says, right? They've got to say something in the beginning, right? But you can't just start out by saying, I can't answer the phone right now. You've got to say something before that, don't you? Right? So that serves the function of the thing that you say before that. And then the second sentence, I can't answer the phone right now. Declarative, interrogative, imperative. Declarative, interrogative, imperative. Declarative, declarative. Declarative, expressing my ability to answer the phone, right? Expressing the fact that I am not able to answer the phone, right? The illocutionary force, what is the person doing when they say this? Okay, he's unable to receive the call. So he's giving you the information that he's unable to receive the call. Right? He's giving you the information that he's not there. Right? So it's also representative. Giving you the information that he's unable to come to the phone now. But, you know, again, there's something kind of funny about that as well. Because if I call you up, and I get your answering machine or I get your voicemail, I know that you're not able to answer the phone because you didn't answer the phone, isn't it? It's obvious. So again, it seems like kind of unnecessary information. Like, why are you telling me you can't answer the phone? Because you didn't answer the phone. I know you can't answer the phone. So what else is going on? What else is the person expressing by saying, I can't answer the phone right now? Very good, very good. It's a kind of apology, right? So again, we have another utterance that does this kind of double work, yeah? That it's actually two different speech acts in one utterance, right? Please leave a message after the tone. What kind of a sentence is this? Declarative, interrogative, imperative. Imperative. And what is the speech act? Directive. Very good. What kind of directive? Is it an order, a suggestion, a request? Yeah. So this is pretty straightforward, isn't it? Because imperatives are always directives. And so the locutionary force and the illocutionary force are the same in this. Not too complicated, this one. It's me again. What kind of sentence is that? Declarative?
Declarative?
It's me again. So it is representative in that it is telling you who I am. It is identifying who I am. Who am I? I'm me. Well, how do I know who they are? If I'm getting this phone message, Heidi has called me up. He leaves a message on my voicemail. He says, hi, it's me. How do I know who it is? Because I recognize his voice, isn't it? Right? So the only reason this person would have said it's me again is because they expect me to recognize their voice, isn't it? Right? In other words, this person believes that I already know who they are. So there is no reason for them to identify themselves, right? And so, like the first two sentences up here, it's a little bit weird. It's giving me information that I obviously don't need to know because I know it's you, and anyway, you're not even telling me who you are, so I must already know who you are, right? And so it must also, it is a representative, but it must also have another function. What do you think the function is? Another greeting, yeah. So, just a way of saying hi, right? It's me again, just a way of saying hi. I'm trying to organize the barbecue for John's birthday on Saturday, okay? What kind of sentence is it? Declarative. What is the person doing with the sentence? It's a representative, right? They're telling what they're doing. They're representing what they're doing right now. Now I'm trying to organize the barbecue for John's birthday on Saturday. So again, this one, very straightforward, right? It's a declarative and a representative. No difference between the locutionary act and the illocutionary act. But then we get to the last sentence. Can you give me a call and let me know if you'll be coming? Okay. So this is an interrogative. Right? It's asking a question. It's asking a question about your ability to give me a call. Kind of a strange question to ask, since I'm calling you on your phone. You obviously have a phone, and you probably know how to use it. You probably read the user's manual. And so the fact that you are able to give me a call is quite obvious, isn't it? So again, we get this kind of strange thing. Why would you ask me if I can give you a call? Of course I can give you a call. You know, I paid my phone bill, right? So, well, the first part, there are two parts in this, right? The second part, I think, is inviting. The first part is a directive. Yeah, what kind of directive? A request. All right? So the first part is a request. And then, let me know if you'll be coming is an invitation. So here we have a situation where the locutionary force and the illocutionary force are different. Right? Not only are they different, but there are two illocutionary forces. One is the force of a request, and the other is the force of an invitation. Threats. We always threaten people or warn people in some way. I quite like this picture. Right? And so here we have a guy here who is threatening Calvin. Right? Now, there are certain direct ways to threaten somebody or to warn somebody. For example, if you want to directly threaten somebody or directly warn somebody, what would you say? I'm warning you, right? Very direct. I'm warning you, right? Or, for a threat, maybe to use a conditional sentence. If you don't leave me alone, I'm going to call the police, right? If you do this, these will be the consequences. That's a threat, right? Very, very clearly a threat. But there are actually many ways which we express a threat without actually using the word warning or using the word threat or using a conditional sentence. For example, how could we threaten somebody? Candy, how would you threaten somebody?
Because it's some gesture and you say, you want to try this?
You want to try this? You want to try this? Would you like a knuckle sandwich? Right? This kind of thing? Yeah? Yeah? So we could use a question. We could use an offer. Yeah? Would you like my face? My fist in your face? Would you like my fist in your face? I can give that to you. Right? Yeah? Would you like to be arrested? Would you like me to call the police? Right? Things like that. So we could use a question. Anything else? Okay, so be careful, right? In a way, you know, be careful is kind of a warning, a kind of pretty direct warning, yeah? How about, I'm worried that you might get killed, something like that, right? So we could use a statement, right? A kind of expressive statement, right? We could use a suggestion, right? I suggest you leave me alone, right? or I suggest you get out of my office, right? So a suggestion. Is it possible to do this speech act without talking? How? It's kind of the way you look at somebody, isn't it? Right? Right, that sort of thing, right? So by facial expressions, by gestures, these sorts of things. And that's not just true of threats and warnings. That's actually true of almost all speech acts, except performatives, right? Performatives cannot, I can't think of any performatives that can be performed without speaking, right? Because the whole thing about performatives is you have to stay there, right? But most other speech acts, you can also perform non-verbally. So you can threaten somebody by looking at them in a certain way. You can apologize to somebody also by looking at them in a certain way. Right? You can request something from somebody by using gestures. You know, like, you know, your friend is eating McDonald's French fries, and you kind of look drooling, and then they know that you want one. And so the point is that speech acts don't necessarily have to be verbal. We can also express our speech acts non-verbally. But in order for something to be a speech act, we need to have certain kinds of conditions. Right? We need to have some kind of conditions that are fulfilled to make the speech act work. Yeah? If these conditions aren't fulfilled, then the speech act won't work. First condition is that the person has to be the right kind of person to do the speech act, right? Other conditions include things like they have to be uttered in the right kinds of context. There has to be a certain understanding between the two people. There has to be certain kinds of intentions involved, right? All of these conditions are called felicity conditions. Felicity conditions. So the whole idea about felicity conditions is that Austin and Searle said that, you know, the old way of analyzing sentences is to analyze whether they're true or not, right? Whether a statement is true. That is, if we're focusing on the propositional content of the sentence, then we judge the sentence based on its truth or its falsehood. But with speech acts, you can't judge based on its truth and its falsehood, because a speech act can't be true or false. For example, an offer can't be true or false. It can only be either clearly understood as an offer or not understood as an offer, right? And so they said, rather than considering whether a speech act is true or not, we're going to use the word happiness. I think it's really wonderful, this word happiness. We are going to consider whether or not the speech act is happy or not. Right? And it's kind of a funny way to put it, but a kind of cute way to put it as well, I think. Right? So what he means by whether the speech act is happy or not is whether it works. Yeah? The degree to which it is likely to work. The degree to which other people around are likely to interpret correctly what speech act you are going to talk about. And among these conditions, felicity conditions for the happiness of the speech act, are three things. First, it's the propositional content, the meaning of the words. Right? You've got to say words that can be reasonably interpreted by the other person as the speech act that you want to do. So the language is important. But another thing that is important is what's called the preparatory condition, that is the context. And the context has to do with who utters the speech act and where they utter the speech act. So, I now pronounce you man and wife can only be a happy speech act when it's uttered by a magistrate or a priest in a church or a courthouse at a certain time to certain people. Right? So, if he's not a priest, if he's not a magistrate, if he's just the cleaner, right, and he utters it, it doesn't work. Right? If he utters it on the MTR, it doesn't work. If he utters it to two small children, it doesn't work, right? Because two small children are not allowed to get married in under Hong Kong law. Right? And so even if he says, I now pronounce you man and wife, these two primary school students are not going to be married. Right? Impossible. Right? So you need all of those conditions to come together. And finally, there's the condition of intention. Right? So in order for the Speech Act to work, I have to believe that it's going to work. And the people to which I do it to also have to believe that it's going to work. We all have to be kind of sincere in our intentions, right? I have to believe that I'm a priest or a magistrate and I have the power to do this. You have to believe that I'm a priest or a magistrate and I have the power to do it. You have to want to get married. Yeah? I can't force you to get married by uttering this speech act. The only way this speech act would work is if you say I do beforehand, isn't it? Right? You know, if I say, Alan, do you take Yo-Yo? And Yo-Yo, do you take Alan? And Yo-Yo says, no, of course not. Right? I can't say, okay, doesn't matter. I now pronounce you man and wife. It doesn't work, does it? Right? So everybody kind of has to agree. This is what we call felicity conditions. So this is an example of the felicity conditions for a promise. All of these conditions have to be fulfilled for a promise to be really a promise. Okay? First of all, it has to be about something that I'm going to do in the future in order to be a promise. It can't be about something that I did in the past. Then it's not a promise, isn't it? I can't say, I promise to, you know, to go to the shops with you last Thursday. Right? Because last Thursday's the past. Right? So it's got to be the future. I've got to say I'm going to do something in the future. And second, I've got to intend to do it. Right? That is, I'm really going to do it. Right? I believe I can do it. I can't promise to do things that I can't do. Right? For example, I can't say, I promise to give you $1 million. Because I don't have $1 million to give you. Right? And so the promise is not happy. Right? It doesn't work. It doesn't function as a promise. Right? I think I would not normally do it. So we don't promise things that we normally do. I promise I'm going to wake up tomorrow. Right? I promise that I'm going to take a bath tomorrow. Right? The only way that would work as a promise is if I don't normally take a bath. Right? So a promise, in order for something to be a promise, it has to be a kind of unique thing, isn't it? Right? It's got to be something special that you are going to do that you would not normally do in order to make it a promise. The other person has to want you to do it. Right? You can't promise to do things that the other person doesn't want you to do. Right? I promise to punch you in the face. Right? It's not a promise. It's a threat. Okay? So it's still a speech act, but it doesn't function as a promise. It's not happy as a promise. It's only happy as a threat. I intend to place myself under an obligation to perform the action. That is, it is my intention, when I'm making a promise, to obligate myself to do this, right? So I'm creating this kind of assignment for myself, right? I've got to do it, and I intend to do it. I know that if I say this, then I am going to be obligated somehow to do it. And if I don't do it, there are going to be some kind of consequences, right? You're going to be angry with me. You're going to, you know, get mad at me. You're going to have a fight with me or argue with me. Some kinds of consequences if I don't fulfill the obligation. We both understand what I'm saying, okay? If one of us doesn't understand what I'm saying, it's not a promise. If I don't understand what I'm saying when I'm making a promise, for example, I'm taking drugs, or I'm asleep, you know, or something like that, then it's not a promise. In fact, there's a recent story that came out in the United States. The Attorney General, who is, he's in charge of the law. He's like the chief lawyer in America, and he's the one who's in charge of saying whether things are legal or not, right? Well, he was very, very sick in the hospital, right? And the president wanted him to sign something that said that that torturing people was legal or something like that, right? And so they brought the paper to the hospital bed, right? And he was like, you know, unconscious on sedatives, right? And they tried to, like, you know, sort of take his hand and make him to sign the document, But, of course, even if he had signed that document, right, it wouldn't have had the force of a speech act that they wanted it to, because he didn't understand what he was signing. He was on drugs. He was unconscious, right? So I have to understand what I'm saying. You have to understand what I'm saying. We are both normal, conscious human beings, right? If somebody who is crazy makes a promise to me, it doesn't have the force of a promise because they're crazy, right? If I make a promise to my dog, it doesn't have the force of a promise because my dog can't do anything, right? My dog can't, you know, can't come to me next week and say, but you promised, right? Because my dog is not a normal, conscious human being. Both of us are in normal circumstances, right? So, for example, you can't, if you make somebody promise something by torturing them, right? By, you know, maybe, you know, tying them up, right? And, you know, forcing them to make the promise, you know, promise, you'll marry me, promise. It doesn't have the force of a promise because you force them to do it, right? And finally, the utterance contains an illocutionary force indicating device. Now, an illocutionary force indicating device is some kind of word in the utterance that signals that it's a promise. And for a promise, it can either be promise, I promise, the word promise, or the future tense verb, I will. Yes, I will do that. Right? But even for will, if it just says will, right, I'm not so sure if it has that much of a force of a promise. Right? I think that for it really to be a promise, you got to say, I promise. Right? Because I can say, oh yeah, you know, I'll buy you something very nice for your birthday. You know, and then I buy you like a mouse pad or something like that. Right? And you say, you promised you'd buy me something nice for my birthday. I say, well, I didn't promise. I just said I would, but I didn't promise. Right? People are always saying, I didn't promise. Right? So with a promise, I think that having that signaling word is particularly important. Right? It's sort of like vowing or swearing. Right? By saying the word promise, you are actually, you know, committing yourself to do that kind of thing. And so for your homework, not really homework, you got a lot of homework, but just, you know, in case you're bored in the next couple of days and you have nothing to do, I wonder if you could think about these things. What are the conditions? And maybe we'll divide it up, okay? So you guys here, you do a marriage proposal, right? You guys here, you do a bet, right? You guys here, you do a request. And you guys here, you do an order. Just list out the things that you think have to be true in order for this thing to actually work, right? For these things to actually work. For example, for a marriage proposal in Hong Kong to be a marriage proposal, to work as a marriage proposal, one condition has to be true, that one person must be male, the other person must be female. That's true, isn't it? Right? But in Massachusetts or in Canada, okay, in Canada, those conditions are not necessary. One person could be female, the other person could be female, and it would still work. Right? So different kinds of conditions for different places as well. So just try to list out as many conditions you can think of that you definitely need to have for this to work as a marriage proposal, a bet, a request, or an order. Okay. So you guys are handing in your assignment when? Next Monday. Did I say next Monday?
You promised.
I promise. I don't think that the litany conditions were there to make that a promise. Yeah. Okay. You know, the other class, they were supposed to hand their assignments in on Friday, and I gave them a little more time, and so they're actually handing them in today. Yeah. So I think it's only fair to give you guys a little more time as well. All right. And so instead of, it was normally Friday, as I recall, yeah, you can hand in your assignments on Monday. Okay? Give you a little more time to do the weekend.
Okay.
Can it be used in Greek core or with
the It could be used in both. Either one. Yeah. Yeah, that's okay as well. Yeah, yeah. If I were you, I would. I think this is probably better for week four, and this is probably better for week five. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. The list is fine. Maybe you can elaborate on the list a little bit to explain it a bit more.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, Hi. And we want to know where you meet tomorrow. You have tomorrow for a meeting of the school meeting?
Yeah, it might actually be in my office, although it's a little bit small. I've got to see if I can book a room. So I'll let you know. Are you coming to the award ceremony? Okay. So I'll let you know at the award ceremony and also send out. Well, the award ceremony is 3 o'clock. Yeah. So please, if you have time, tomorrow come to the award ceremony for the scholarship. All right, we're giving away lots of money tomorrow. So if you're lucky, maybe you'll get some of it. Yeah, so come along, and even if you don't get any money, there's going to be free food as well. So, yeah.
Okay.
Questions? Take a second. There you are. Just find your friend.
What does it mean by cross-fertilization in this paper?
Cross-fertilization means that stuff from one community affects stuff from other communities. So there's a kind of a mixture, a cross-fertilization. Think of it like plants. Yeah? And so you have one kind of bean growing here, one kind of bean growing here. But since they're growing so close to each other, then some of the seeds from this bean go over there, and some of the seeds from this bean go over there. That's a cross-fertilization.
You won't count these words, right? I'm drawing lots of graphs.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
And you won't count these, right?
No. I won't count. That's great. Is this actually from your from your side of the investigation?
And my ethnographic data is accurate because I'm actually the participant.
Oh, that's great.
For a long time. So the depth is really, really
that's
long.
Wonderful.
I'm afraid I'm dropped out from this class.
Why?
I can't find my card.
You can't find your card. Okay, it's okay. I think your card is up in the file for the other class. But it's okay.
It's okay.
It'll be
fine.
Thanks. Yeah.
See you.
Okay, bye.
We don't usually have pictures for job application forms, right?
Hmm?
These kind of pictures, we don't usually have it.
No.